Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today, Steve and I are going to be talking about vampires, a creature that has existed in one form or another around the world for thousands of years. Granted, we are going to focus on the 17th century when the whole of Europe went vampire crazy, and of course the novels and films that would forever change the world's perception of vampires, but I'm hoping to show that those who drink blood and are undead come in a variety of types around the world. We will not have time to cover all bloodsuckers, mind you, but we are trying to stick to those that are more akin to the vampires by modern definition. But before we dive into that, was there anything you wanted to say, Steve?
A few things, sure. Now, keep in mind that right now I kind of have some Top Gun stuff going over my head, so can't hear me. That's the reason. Anyway, vampires are really a thing of folklore that ended up becoming its own brand of horror. Some of the classic monsters, the iconic ones, came about just because there were weird phenomena that the medieval world couldn't explain. Usually the real causes were diseases that weren't understood at that time or some other explainable phenomena, but well, by today's standards at least. But the stories were shared by word of mouth and by people who didn't know what they were dealing with. So those stories gradually got bigger and bigger, and suddenly you have blood-sucking monsters that burn in daylight. But Mike, why don't we get into how the idea of the vampire came about specifically?
Sure, Steve. I mean, you have the basics there already, but actually before the 18th century, the term vampire didn't really exist. The word itself is derived from the Slavic umpir, meaning bloodsucker, and has changed over the centuries to vampire. The whole idea about vampirism comes from watching a person bleed out and seeing them die. To a primitive mind, the association was made that if blood leaving the body meant death, then blood itself must be the source of life. Then, of course, they considered, well, what happens if you put the blood back in? Might it return life to the body? But this belief that life is in the blood was not just a superstition either. Leviticus 17:11 reads, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul. Therefore, I said to the children of Israel, no one among you shall eat blood, nor shall any stranger who dwells among you eat blood." In other words, even the Bible says that life is in the blood and then strictly forbids anyone from consuming it for that reason, which gives it an unholy cursed effect. So basically, the belief was that drinking blood could grant a kind of cursed immortality.
Interesting. I'm pretty sure that Bram Stoker was inspired by that passage. The blood is the life is a recurring quote throughout his writing of Dracula. And that line has been adapted a number of times. And also, when you're talking about cursed immortality, Renfield is pursuing the exact same thing. And this is what Dracula gives him. But we'll talk more about that when we get to Prince Vlad III of Wallachia and his influence on the entire vampire genre.
That does make sense as an influence there. But as you said, we'll get into that. Much like the hysteria surrounding the Salem witch trials, a series of odd disappearances, markings on corpses, and suspicious activity around graveyards and cemeteries in the Balkans and Eastern Europe led to accusations of vampirism. This early route around death, corpses, and graveyards also came with certain implications about vampires that were not shaken off until Polidori's The Vampire from 1819. What things, you ask? Early vampires were not associated with class or sophistication, and they damn sure weren't sexy. When people thought about them, they thought about rot, decay, sickness, and disease, because it was all centered around where the dead were kept. People have known for thousands of years to keep the dead away from everything else. However, Even with this common element, each country and region of the Balkans and Eastern Europe had their own version of what a vampire is. Some of the more popular ones of the day were Lamastu, Lilith, Lamia, and Pusa, who were all female, either demons or succubus, or is it succubi? I'm not actually sure, but in fact, in Romania, almost all vampires, or rather strigoi, are women and are associated with witchcraft or sorcery, and not all of them drink blood, but do consume human flesh and kill. When one of them dies, they can reanimate and rise again, even more powerful than before. However, one can become a strigoi in a number of ways, through an unholy life, an improper burial, a curse, and of course, having their blood drunk by another strigoi.
Interesting that you mentioned the strigoi. I mean, there were similar beings who were adapted in the Witcher series, and that series takes its influences from Polish legend. So I'm guessing that many Eastern European nations had their own versions of what we'll call proto-vampires. You're also correct that vampires were definitely not regarded as cool or sexy as they became in modern times. These creatures were seen as unholy monsters, and they were intended to be scary. Oftentimes, these kinds of monsters were used to frighten children into good behavior or as a cautionary tale to avoid the consequences of immoral behavior. Be good or the strigoi will get you, that kind of thing. But they were also designed to explain the unexplainable in a way that medieval people could understand. They didn't understand germs or viruses. These ideas didn't exist at that time. But those people could understand things in terms of their faith. So vampires became unholy and evil creatures that drink the blood of the living.
They're definitely different versions of vampires from around the globe. However, I found this bit interesting. In Romanian, Greek, and Latin, you see the word strigoi. But also across other parts of Eastern Europe, there are tales of the strigoi, those who have risen from the grave and can only survive by drinking the blood of others. Romanian mythology specifically mentions that they are capable of turning invisible or even into animals. There's a good chance that this is where the idea of vampires turning into bats came from. These strigoi were divided into three classes, witches, living strigoi, and those that have been risen from the dead. And this bit is interesting, too. The word strigoi, or rather variations of it, can be found in other languages, too. Among these sources, those of them that do not refer to a witch or a sorceress refer to a bird-like creature that looked similar to an owl, but hung upside down like a bat. But in all of the cases, the creature either eats human flesh, drinks human blood, or both. In Greek, it was the Strix. But there are some accounts, like in the Albanian Striga, where it is a vampiric witch that sucks blood of infants at night while they sleep and then turns into a flying insect, traditionally like a moth, a fly, or a bee. Striga in French is a bird woman that sucks blood. The Strigonin in Italian refers to a witch or a sorcerer.
Huh. So it does seem like the strigoi evolved into the Polish striga that we saw in the Witcher series, as well as those other variations that you've listed. Stories travel from place to place, and while the names and details change, the core of the story remains basically intact. I did some recent reading, and you get some legends even as far as the Canary Islands off the coast of Spain. There were beings called the Witches of Anaga that were reputed to be vampiric and drank the blood of children. But let's get back into Europe proper for now.
I find it interesting that the go-to targets are often children. You know, harm coming to our children is something that all parents fear. So, I mean, it just kind of makes sense that would be their go-to fear with that. But back to the strigoi. The first account of the strigoi that I could find out of Europe in the 17th century came in 1656 in what we would call modern Croatia and Central Europe. A man named Yuri Grondo started terrorizing his village after his death by supposedly rising from the grave and knocking on people's doors. Those houses he would knock on would experience a death within the next few days. One time, Grondo appeared to his widowed wife, gasping for air, but somehow still maintaining a sinister grin. This went on for 16 years and until the village finally killed him. But how did they do that? Check this out. The priest who buried Grondo led a group of villagers on a quest to kill him. When they came upon him, a man tried to jam a wooden pole through the creature's heart, but his skin was too tough and it just bounced off. So the priest pulled out his cross and said, "Behold, Jesus Christ, you vampire, stop tormenting us." And the vampire fled. They found him later in his coffin, and his body was perfectly preserved as if it hadn't aged a day, and he had a smile on his face. They tried to stab him in the heart again, this time with a wooden stake, but it could not penetrate the skin. So the priest performed an exorcism, but it did nothing. Another villager took a saw and decapitated the vampire with it as the vampire screamed in pain, noting that the skin around the neck was easier to get through. Apparently, blood poured out from the open wound, but after that, the vampire was at last dead.
That's a very cool story, but I can't help but wonder what the real story is behind that. I mean, maybe Grando was wrongly presumed dead, buried alive, and dug himself out, and then the village mistook him for a vampire? I mean, I could understand being pretty pissed off at the villagers if that happened. Still, it does make a really cool vampire tale, whatever the truth is.
I do know that air and gases get trapped in the lungs during decomposition, and that like, you know, you imagine them like them trying to pressing down on a chest or something like that, that those gases and air escaping from the lungs through the vocal cords likely explains the screaming and pain sound. Although I imagine it was more of a moan than a scream. Also, they were under the impression that the blood stays congealed, which it doesn't. In fact, rigor mortis isn't permanent either. So when liquid blood came out, they jumped to conclusions. But that's all I can say about it medically on that. But after this story got around, people in Romania and surrounding areas began taking certain precautions to protect themselves from the Strigoian vampires. A dominant belief at the time was that vampires would consume so much blood from living humans and animals that it would begin to leak out of their eyes, ears, mouth, and nose. It was believed that some men, particularly redheads, could return from the dead in the form of an animal and sneak into a house and feed upon young women. Again, that's another common go-to fear associated with that.
Gingers have no souls.
Right? Gruesome and terrible deaths, be they suicides or murders, peculiar circumstances surrounding one's birth, and even things done in life, like being an alcoholic or even just being a criminal, could mean that you might turn into a vampire after you die. To avoid this and other vampires, people who had these things in their past, their coffins were nailed shut, and oftentimes they would stake them through the heart before they were buried. If they even suspected that someone might be one of these undead, they would dig up the body, and if it was not decayed, they would cut open the back and take out the corpse's heart and cut it in two. A nail would be driven into its forehead, and a clove of garlic would be placed under its tongue. After this, they would bury them face down so that the Strigoi would wake up and be sent immediately to the afterlife. Or in many cases, they would just burn the body. One belief from folklore is that headstones themselves are intended to weigh down the body and prevent it from rising. In fact, if a headstone was tilted, it meant that the vampire or remnant inside was able to leave the grave and kill. In one case, a woman was found to have acquired vampirism by eating meat of a cow that had vampirism after they dug up her body. So they dug up 20 other graves and found 14 more corpses that had signs of vampires, and they did all that shit to them too. Bear in mind, all of this was government sanctioned, and according to Romanian law at the time, they believed this was a plague they needed to stomp out.
Talk about mad cow disease. My understanding, though, is that the Romanian people developed a very complex system of superstitions that still endures to this day. I mean, it's a really fascinating cultural development, and I can't think of another country that does this quite this way. I can't help but wonder how prevalent these kinds of vampire cases were back then, and what caused the Romanians to be that convinced that the undead bloodsuckers really existed.
You know, one of the biggest things that attributed to this widespread belief in vampires was that the men who were hunting them and reporting about them were no quacks. Vampire hunters in the European tradition were by definition well-educated individuals. These men held esteemed positions in highly regarded universities as teachers and writers. They were doctors of philosophy, theology, and history. At the same time, they held a they had a fundamental belief that vampires existed. So they would abandon their positions or go on sabbaticals to visit every place they thought an actual vampire attack or other occurrence had happened. There were also certain people whose behavior seemed to lend some credence to the idea of vampirism. Take Countess Elizabeth Bathory, aka the Blood Countess from the 16th century. Legend has it that she used the blood of young girls to give her skin a youthful appearance, but she did far worse in reality. She recorded in her own diary accounts of 650 women she had killed and consumed parts of because she believed the old adage that you are what you eat, and she wanted the youth of the girls she killed and ate. Granted, that isn't actually vampirism, but I mean, you can see how a factual account like that could lend to the idea that vampirism is in fact valid and real.
True. Here you also see a bit of Bram Stoker's influences coming in now that you talk about vampire hunters. After all, what kind of man is Abraham Van Helsing? I mean, he's an educated man, a doctor, and a man of learning who's an expert in vampiric lore. He's also a man of faith who accepts things outside of conventional medicine. This is exactly the kind of man who would have been a vampire hunter back during that time. Now, the Blood Countess is an interesting story and one that gets used in vampire stories a lot in the modern day. Nowadays, she would probably be regarded as a serial killer, and I think that's really what she was historically. If you're a powerful noblewoman, I mean, it would be easy to acquire victims, you know, just through the power, money, and influence she possessed. It's a true crime story that became a vampire story because the details are consistent with vampirism. But it's also because Bathory's crimes are lurid and unspeakable. I mean, even for that time, especially for that time, you can totally understand why writers would use her as an inspiration for a fictional villain.
Oh, she was definitely a serial killer, and a very prolific one, in fact. I don't personally know of any other serial killer who racked up numbers that high, and I've actually looked quite a bit into serial killers. But back to vampire hunters. After some time, a vampire hunter's kit was developed and often included a mallet, a wooden stake, and a crucifix. It might have a rope, certain crowbars, and in later times, even a pistol. Apparently, some types of vampires like the Nosferatu are susceptible to bullet wounds. Garlic was another common element. Its odor was believed to overpower the stench of the corpse and frighten it away. If the hunter was ordained by the church, this kit could also include holy water, holy oil, and the Holy Eucharist. The elements in the kit often had both religious and symbolic meaning to them. The stake, for instance, was symbolic of pinning the vampire to the ground through penetration. By doing this, you ended its spiritual life and brought it once again in contact with the earth, and this would bring on decomposition and the process of death would take its course. However, many of the beliefs of the day would be disproven by future science, especially as it pertains to the dead and things that can happen to a corpse after death. Really, though, you can't blame them for thinking any of these things, as they were just going by the knowledge they had in the day. I mean, is that not what we're doing too?
Right. I mean, we're all just making do with the knowledge that we have. But here's something interesting. Not too long ago, I saw an article about an authentic vampire hunter's kit that sold for a pretty decent amount of money, and it included all those things that you listed here. I mean, it looks like the kind of thing I could see Buffy using, but it is true that these people were going by the science that existed at the time. I mean, our current understanding of medical science was just not available to them back then, so they had to find some kind of explanation for these things they couldn't explain.
Honestly, all mythology and folklore, even if originally based on an actual event or a person, is an attempt to explain the unknown. In Romanian mythology, there were also other undead vampires, including, and I think you might recognize this one, Steve, the Dompier, literally translated to drink with teeth. If you don't recognize the name right off, let me elaborate on the Dompier, and I think you'll find this story familiar. The Dompier were hybrid creatures born from the union between a vampire and a human, or even a pregnant woman's child after being bitten by a vampire. A Dompier being born in and of itself is very rare due to the vampire's undead nature, which may result in a lack of fertility. However, when it does happen, in most stories, a Dompier is born from a female human and a male vampire, with the opposite being even rarer. In stories, Dompiers will commonly become vampire hunters if they do not succumb to their own bloodlust and vampiric origins. Many of these become quite successful as well, as they generally have the same power set too, and only some or even none of all of the weaknesses of their vampire parent, who they may also actually include in their hunt. And it's got to be screaming at you by now, Steve.
Oh, yeah. That's no doubt where Vampire Hunter D came from. D is probably the best known Dampir in vampire fiction, and I'm sure his creators drew on that lore when they created D. I mean, now Blade is kind of similar as well, even though nobody ever calls him a Dampir, that he's more called a Daywalker there. But I have seen Dampir elsewhere too. I mean, in fact, the video game Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous, you can play your main player character as a Dampir if you want to. There, too, it's played as a hybrid between a vampire and a mortal, and it is fun to play. But why don't we get back to the folklore?
That sounds like a great idea, Steve. So here I'm going to take a minute to talk about some of the many different types of vampires from around the world. In Albanian mythology, there are vampire-like creatures called the Lugat that abide in shadows and darkness, especially places that never see sunlight, such as inside water wells, old ruins, and caves. They have a frightening visage and are extremely violent. A Lugat can fly and ride the winds and assails his victims in their sleep. He also lures people, especially children, to himself while he is concealed in the darkness. This one is a little weird, but in Australia, according to Aboriginal myth, there is a creature called the Yarmayahu that was a small red frog-like man that hid in the trees and jumped down onto unsuspecting people and drained their blood before swallowing them whole. Then, after taking a nap, which is a funny part of this, I think. I don't know. It's just me. It would regurgitate a smaller living version of the people he just ate, and now they have a reddish tint to their skin. This process is repeated over and over again until the victims themselves become a Yarmayahu. In Western Africa, there are legends of the Asambosam, a creature with iron teeth, long red hair, and hooks for feet. Like the Yarmayahu, the Asambosam hangs from the trees and attacks from above and drains their victim of blood. In the Philippines, there is a Mananangal, which is a rather hideous-looking creature with an elongated tongue that it uses to suck the hearts out of unborn fetuses and pregnant women. It can also detach its torso from its legs and sprout bat-like wings. When it does this, it's at its most vulnerable and is susceptible to salt, holy water, and garlic. Apparently, rubbing crushed garlic, salt, or ash on its lower half while it's separated can kill it, as it prevents it from rejoining its lower half. And if it doesn't rejoin by sunrise, it dies. In Malaysia, there is the Penanggalan, who is a ghostly spirit that wanders about with her entrails hanging beneath her. The difference between her and the Mananangal is that the Penanggalan is actually a living woman who practices black magic, as opposed to some type of undead. She performs a ritual in a vat of vinegar that allows her to take this hideous form. In China, there is the Jiangshi, who are reanimated corpses who are so stiff with rigor mortis that they hop around and look for victims to take the precious life force of their blood.
Huh. I knew there were a bunch of different vampires around the world, though the only one of those I knew by name were the Jiangshi. I mainly know them because they appear in another video game called Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. And by the way, that game is awesome and you should play it. You actually fight the Jiangshi in that game, and they're pretty tough. I think the other varieties are interesting and worth using somewhere in a story, though. Whatever phenomenon that these creatures were meant to explain or reflect, though, it's one that crosses cultures from all around the world.
That it does, Steve. There are a crap ton of different types of vampires, so nailing down a specific type can be difficult. But none of them, from anywhere, sparkle like a diamond in the sunlight. Twilight.
Don't even get me started on that one. I'll have plenty of things to say on Twilight later, I expect. Spoiler warning, none of them are good. But you were saying, Mike?
There is one common trait in vampirism. They all drink blood, or in some way they consume the life force of others. According to many history books, the oldest ancient deity who consumed blood was probably Lilith. She is also described as the first demon, or a female spirit which exemplified all of the darkest attributes of the world. The custom of consuming blood always had a magical or mysterious meaning. It was used as a part of of witchcraft or as a symbolic connection of the powers of life and death, as a religious practice, or as a form of offerings to the gods. But it was also believed, because life is in the blood, that the reason the undead and vampires required blood was to consume the life force within it. The most ancient source we have for the dead needing blood comes from the Odyssey, where Odysseus travels to the land of the dead to gain knowledge from the deceased seer Tiresias. And while he is there, he speaks to his mother, Achilles, and Agamemnon before he can do any of that, they have to drink the blood of a goat that Odysseus has emptied into a pit, as blood gives them the strength to recall their life. The dead greatly desire the blood, and in fact, it's what draws them there. Only Tiresias is able to speak to him and recognize him before drinking the blood because of his exceptional abilities as a seer. What's a little weird is that the people Odysseus were talking to were spirits, and I don't know how a spirit drinks blood. But as we saw with the Strigoi, they were referred to as spirits sometimes too. So perhaps spirit did not always mean ethereal.
Maybe not. I'm wondering if the Greek idea of blood is related to sacrifices, though, or blood offerings to the gods. It was common to sacrifice goats and other small animals to the Olympian gods. So maybe it relates to the idea of sacrificing a life so that another can gain strength by it. Still, the connection of vampire legends is interesting. Also, keep in mind that Odysseus was given guidance about how to traverse the underworld by Circe, who was both a goddess and a practicing witch. So there, too, you have the idea of a powerful female figure who is involved in blood rituals, just as we see with Lilith. But it could be that I'm reaching with some of this.
I don't think you're reaching at all with that. As we discussed already, witchcraft and sorcery are heavily tied to vampirism. In fact, in several cultures, the word for witch and vampire are the exact same word. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me that Circe would have that knowledge. But that's all history, myth, and legend. When it comes to fictional vampires, things are a bit more uniform. The abomination of Twilight excluded, in fact. We've come to expect certain tropes from vampires, things like fearing crosses, garlic, silver, and sunlight, and of course the sharp fangs that they feed with. Let's not forget not having a shadow or not having a reflection and not being able to step foot on consecrated ground or even into someone's home without being invited. Luckily for them, they are often off the charts in charisma and intelligence. And actually, as a side note, for thousands of years, the dead were thought to know hidden secrets and have knowledge of both what has been and what will come. Odin himself carried around a dead seer because she had said knowledge. Even the Draugr from the Norse, a spirit attached to the corpse of a dead man, was an intelligent being. All of that to say, the vampire as an extremely intelligent being is not happenstance on the part of the writers. But they are also very fast and extremely strong. They can fly and even compel both humans and animals to serve them.
The Draugr are interesting, though I'm unsure if they're closer to vampires or zombies. I mean, in Vodden versions, at least, the Draugr is treated more like Viking-style zombies. But then it's just maybe my having played Skyrim way too much.
No, they are definitely closer to zombies. I only reference them to show the commonality of intelligence associated with the dead.
Got you. That makes sense to me. But I guess we should talk about how the folklore led to the modern vampire. And that starts with 19th century literature, so why don't we get into that?
I'd be happy to. Because of books like The Vampire by John William Polidori, or more famous, Bram Stoker's Dracula, they have gone from being hideous undead monsters to classy, sexy masters of seduction. Hell, Dracula is actually a Transylvanian lord living in a castle, a far cry from the undead who hung around graveyards and snuck into people's houses. But to be fair, Count Dracula was modeled after Vlad the Impaler, a Romanian ruler, and also borrowed heavily from Lord Ruthven in Polidori's novelette The Vampire from 1819, even if much of the story takes place in Greece rather than in Transylvania. Stoker and Polidori portrayed the vampires as elite, seductive, and both of them took great joy in corrupting their victims before draining their victims of blood. However, where Bram Stoker differed was leaning heavily into Romanian folklore and the subject of God, good and evil. In fact, as I understand Bandit, Stoker only went with Vampire instead of Strigoi because there was a very little difference as far as the kind of creature Dracula was and a Strigoi, and the word Vampire was more popular in English than the Romanian Strigoi. Oddly enough, even with all the superstition and lore surrounding vampires being full of such things, Polidori didn't even touch the subject of folklore or good and evil. God wasn't even a part of it.
I think when we talk about Dr. Polidori's The Vampire, I can't overlook the biggest influence on the Lord Ruthven character. Ruthven was based quite noticeably on Lord Byron, who was both a renowned poet and a notorious womanizer. Byron's exploits were so scandalous, in fact, that he was exiled from polite society in England, and he had to leave the country. Byron spent a lot of time in Greece after that, and even fought in a war there, which is probably why The Vampire is set in Greece. Byron's influence also explains the way that the vampire became sexed up around that time. Now, another interesting fact about Lord Ruthven. Polidori took part in the same storytelling contest in Lake Geneva that led to Mary Shelley's creation of Frankenstein's monster. If I remember correctly, Byron proposed a contest to see which of them could tell the best horror story. I believe that they were staying at the Villa Diodati, which Byron was renting at the time. They had been reading some German ghost stories, and it sparked the idea that each of the guests would write their own. Polidori then created the vampire as his offering in the contest, using Lord Byron as a model for his titular monster. It's very possible that Polidori had learned about vampire legends through Byron, who was very well-traveled and extremely well-read. I wouldn't be surprised if the vampire legends had reached Germany by the Romantic era. Polidori could well have taken bits of things he'd learned from Byron, then adapted bits of Byron's life and created Ruthven based on those ideas. Now, Stoker came along much later, but probably he was aware of the Polidori story. There was another notable vampire story between them, though, a book called Carmilla, which was written by an Irishman named Sheridan Le Fanu. Carmilla was based on a number of different sources, but the main influence probably was Elizabeth Bathory, the Blood Countess. Carmilla is a female vampire who seduces and preys on young women, much like Bathory. But there's an element of romanticism in it as well. It's a missing link between Polidori and Stoker, and definitely an influence on later female vampires.
That is rather interesting. I had no idea there was another vampire novel in there, and written by an Irishman at that. I'm going to have to look into that with how you're talking about it. But speaking of Stoker, another thing Stoker added from the Balkans is their male Strigoi. They are often driven by lust for women, and that is certainly something that comes up in Dracula. However, in both versions, the vampire started off as a mortal, and because of that, in Romanian and Greek folklore, he is more akin to a witch or a sorcerer than turned into a vampire rather than just a vampire as out and out. Oftentimes, vampires can even be an anti-hero or a romanticized villain, like in the case of Anne Rice's Vampire Lestat, or maybe a tortured soul seeking redemption for the horrors they were forced to commit because of what they are, like the character Louis.
I think Louis and Lestat were models of the modern vampire anti-hero, but I think we'll get into that once we get to Rice. I mean, it took another century or so for that transformation to fully take place. Now, while the Romantics and the Victorians certainly played up the sexuality of the vampire more than it had been up until that time, they were not yet the cool, seductive anti-heroes that we see today. The Victorians especially tended to emphasize the fact that the vampire was still a monster. There was rampant sexuality, but Stoker particularly interpreted this behavior with what were very paternal Victorian attitudes. To him, this was a bad thing. Dracula was a monster who was preying on quote-unquote virtuous women like Mina Murray. There wasn't any other romantic justification for Dracula's actions like we see in the Francis Ford Coppola version. That was a more modern interpretation that was in line with the way vampires were changing in the 1990s. Dracula in the book was always portrayed as a fiend who is a thief to Victorian society and that consequently must be destroyed. This attitude is probably rooted in xenophobia based on fears of miscegenation between quote-unquote proper English women and the foreign other. That kind of thinking, while indefensible by today's standards, was all too common among English writers at the time. So vampires became foreign monsters that were using their sexuality as a weapon to prey on young women. which is unfortunately a very condescending take that is both xenophobic and treats women as victims with little to no real agency. Dracula is a classic novel, and it's beautifully written, but it's got a lot of problematic overtones like that. Where we start seeing the more modern, sexy anti-hero vampires is probably around the 80s and 90s. By that point, cultural attitudes had evolved much more, much closer to modern standards. And you have writers like Anne Rice that changed the game completely. Rice completely flipped the script on how we saw vampires, presenting them as more sympathetic and playing up the sexuality of the vampire. She also added to the mythology of the vampire legend, I mean, making them more powerful and dangerous in ways we hadn't seen before. Lestat in particular is very much the model of how we see vampires nowadays. I mean, he's unapologetically a predator, but he's fascinating. He's charismatic. I actually really like the way Tom Cruise portrayed him in the film. I mean, I feel like he got Lestat, and he brought the Brat Prince petulance as well as the stylishness of the character.
I am in 100% agreement there. Granted, I didn't like them changing Lestat's motivations for turning Louis. You know, in the book, it was essentially a business transaction. Lestat wanted Louis's plantation because he needed a place for his dying father. It did turn into a relationship, but that was afterwards, and not just because Lestat was just too lonely to live alone, which the movie made out to be Lestat's whole mission. I also took issue with Lestat flying in the first film, as he didn't even learn that until Akasha teaches him in Queen of the Damned, the third book, by the way. But I mean, whatever issues I may have with the film, Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, and Antonio Banderas as Armand were flat on amazing in their roles. But more to your point, Cruise definitely nailed the Brat Prince. Interesting thing about the Armand character, though. By the mid-18th century, the French had, in fact, become obsessed with tales of vampires, too. There were apparently several plays produced about vampires during that time. And in reading that, I couldn't help but think of the Théâtre de Vampires that reside in Paris under the cemetery and perform plays about vampires in the Vampire Chronicles. Or, as Louis said in Interview with the Vampire, they are vampires pretending to be humans that are pretending to be vampires. I have to believe that this is not a coincidence and that Rice created the Théâtre de Vampires because it fits so well into history.
Very, very possible. I mean, Rice always did very well with her research, and there probably was some truth behind the idea. I mean, I like that her vampires essentially are hiding in plain sight, trying to fit into mortal society while remaining apart from it. And really, it's a good way to lure in humans to feed on. I mean, it's a cool idea, and it works.
It works so well, too. I loved in the movie how they brought on that woman and flat out surrounded and devoured her on stage in front of everyone as she cried out for help and from anyone. I mean, just looking around the audience and stuff, and no one did anything because the vampires made it seem as if it were all part of the show with very good special effects. I mean, can you just imagine the rave reviews that performance got and how many more will come to witness them kill people again and again? I'd say that works might be an understatement.
More like a snuff film, but yeah.
Yeah, basically. That was just positively brilliant, if you ask me. But I'm a huge Vampire Chronicles fanboy. I saw the movie first, and it inspired me to read the book, and I was instantly hooked. I would spend the next several years reading them. Before I get into Rice's Vampires, how did you get into the Vampire Chronicles, and did you become hooked like I did? Like immediately reading them back to back until you were all caught up?
Kind of. I came into the Vampire Chronicles a little late, to be honest. I want to say it was around the time of the movie, but I could be misremembering. But I came in around the third or fourth books, and then I went backwards and caught up on them. I also branched out into Rice's other stuff too, including the Mayfair Witches, the Mummy, Ramses the Damned, and Servant of the Bones, the latter of which I really love. There was a time when I lived and breathed the Vampire Chronicles, though it's been a long time since then. And then I read Men Knock the Devil, and I decided that Lestat got the ending he deserved at the end of that book, and then I walked away. I mean, I love the character of Lestat, and despite that, it should be said, but that was the ending he needed.
Well, you know, I have to give you that. It was well earned. And Lestat is a complicated character. And if you're like me, you probably went through stages of loving and hating him. I mean, for instance, I hated him in Interview with the Vampire. it just the whole his whole how he treated Louis and Claudia and his just his whole his thing. It just it she really makes you hate him in that book. And then she puts out the second book, The Vampire Lestat, and you just love him, right? And then Queen of the Dam comes out, good, but. Again, I ended up hating him again when he raped the girl in Tale of the Body Thief. I actually had a girlfriend point out to me that that was a little ridiculous. I mean, she hadn't read the books, but in her opinion, if Lestat was a vampire, he'd likely done way worse things. But I got to admit, it bugged me. But that's a tangent for another time, I guess. While we're on the topic, though, Anne Rice represents a couple of points of view as far as the life of a vampire, and I'd like to point those out here. There were vampires like Lestat that believed being a vampire was about living life to the fullest, and that often meant living an upper-class life and renting and buying expensive houses and wearing the nicest clothes. Then there were vampires like Santino, who believed that vampires were pure evil and did not deserve such opulence. They were undead, unholy creatures, not worthy of living anywhere but under a cemetery. Then, of course, there were vampires like Marius, who trained Amadeo, aka Armand, to only kill evildoers, almost as if that redeemed them for killing in the first place. And last but not least, let's look at vampires like Akasha, the Queen of the Damned. She believed that vampires were superior beings and gods over the cattle of mankind, which makes sense considering her and Enkil were worshipped as gods in ancient Egypt. Also, as a side note, I have played the role-playing game Vampire the Masquerade, the one that video game you played was based off of, and I can't help but think that those divisions among the vampires in Rice's novels didn't influence White Wolf's creators into making the different clans of vampires. I say this because the different clans of vampires were not just different types of vampires, but their politics and world views were different. I have to say I'm definitely in the camp where I would only want to kill evildoers. I'm not sure I could even feed on rats like Louis with good conscience. If I was going to kill, it would need to be a villain. And yes, I feel like that would justify my murdering a man or woman if I was a vampire. As I wouldn't age like everyone else, I would be less inclined to be well known in any social circles. So I don't see myself in the high society life. At the same time, I'm not living under a cemetery in the dirt. I think how Louis and Claudia went from place to place when they were running from Lestat is more like what I do. Never really taken a route anywhere. Do you have any thoughts on vampire politics, Steve? Like, if you were a vampire, what would your politics or worldview be?
Well, before I get into that, I will say, yeah, it's very probable that World of Darkness was influenced by Anne Rice. I think that's very likely. But to get to your question, I'd probably be closer to Louis' perspective on things. I mean, I just can't see myself just casually preying on people the way other vampires do. I mean, even losing my humanity and becoming immortal doesn't give me that right. And it's very entirely possible to live a vegetarian existence as a vampire. And you could very well pass an everyday society without, you know, living in cemeteries. There's nothing wrong with drinking from animals or taking small amounts of blood from willing people without killing them. I also don't think I would want to be involved in the doings of most of the other vampires, who are probably all worse than any humans could ever be. I definitely don't want to be involved in the ideological power struggles. I just want to live my way and just not want to get mixed up in that stuff.
I could totally see that, and I can understand it too. You know, morality holds a higher place than anything else, and murder is wrong, period. Even if you think you have an excuse for it. Except I feel like I need a clarification. Do you mean avoiding vampires and well, probably people for that matter, in those types of struggles? Or do you mean not having any immortal companionship at all by like avoiding vampires, period?
Just avoiding vampires that are not involved in the power struggles. I mean, I'd be fine hanging out with vampires who aren't actively trying to murder people or take over the world. And honestly, like, you know, humans are perfectly fine as long as I'm can avoid the temptation to feed on them.
All right. That's, that sounds like a struggle to me, personally. That existence, definitely. But here's another big question that comes up again and again in the Vampire Chronicles. Turning others into vampires. Some feel like it's a damnation and a curse that they would not put anyone through it, even if they begged. The basic idea being that without experiencing immortality, there's no way to truly make the decision to be changed into a vampire from an informed position. I would liken it unto not being able to make informed medical decisions without a medical degree. Some might have an idea, but what's going on in the doctor's head when she explains things to the person is not the same as what's going on when that person's uneducated brain. A decision about choosing the immortal life of a vampire requires knowledge that you just can't get beforehand. For that reason, it's wrong to change a person, even if they are willing. At the same time, Lestat would probably say that people have free will, and if they want to dive headlong into the long dark of the vampire life, murdering and killing to survive, then that's up to them. What's more, with as much as I hate the movie making it Lestat's entire thing, Lestat did truly enjoy Louis and Claudia's company and thought of them like family. Granted, Lestat didn't care at all about how Louis and Claudia felt, but it does show a different perspective. I would like to say that I'm in the first camp, and I would probably stay away from turning anybody for the first 150 years or so. But after watching everyone I know die multiple times, I must admit that I would long for some type of immortal friends. So I think I might do it. And there's a good possibility it would come back to bite me in the ass, as they hate me for it later. But it could also turn out like David Talbot. What do you think about turning others into vampires if you were a vampire?
I didn't choose the vampire life. The vampire life chose me. anyway, that's a complicated question. I mean, in theory, I'm not completely against it. And I understand totally why vampires would want to create others of their kind. The loneliness of surviving the centuries is probably unbearable for most people to endure. That having been said, you have to be very careful about not only who you choose to bring into this life with you, you have to be careful about what happens after you turn them. Because if you're not, you're potentially creating a monster. And I mean that quite literally. Either because they have that seed of wrongness within them to start with, or because vampirism corrupts absolutely. There's also the issue of consent. And I honestly think you should not turn someone against their will the way that Lestat did with David. It gets even creepier when you consider the drinking of blood as a sexual act, where turning someone without their consent really starts crossing lines. I think there are circumstances under which it's fine, such as the case of Louis, but that's because Louis was a strongly moral person in life to begin with, and it was consensual. But there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that decision, and responsibility is something Lestat is bad at.
What? He handled watching those who must be kept perfectly. But you bring up some good points there that make me reconsider, and I think we've actually covered all the sides of it. So with as much as I could talk about the Vampire Chronicles all day, we do have to get back to talking about what film and television shows have influenced our perceptions of vampires. So where do we go in pop culture after the Vampire Chronicles, Steve?
Well, from there, we start seeing more sympathetic vampires in other media. One notable example was Bram Stoker's Dracula, which Francis Ford Coppola intended as a generally book-accurate take on the story. And for the most part, it does get a lot of things right. However, the biggest departure in the film takes from Stoker's novel is the portrayal of Dracula himself. I mean, not only do we get Gary Oldman's very sexualized take on the Prince of Wallachia, the story actively makes changes to his backstory to make him more of a sympathetic villain. The movie introduced the idea that Mina Murray was a reincarnation of Dracula's wife, who really was a real person, and she did die tragically, as shown in the film. That is historically true. The film introduces some real history into Dracula's backstory, which, in fairness, is a good approach to take. But then they attempt to change his motivations by showing that Dracula became a vampire because he cursed God for what happened to his wife, which was never in the book. But then the next big change for vampires came with Joss Whedon and the shows that put him on the map, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and its spinoff Angel. While I think those shows probably would take a whole episode to really talk about in depth, I think the relevant bit here is the soap opera take on vampires. One of the most memorable elements of the first three seasons is the doomed romance between Buffy and the vampire Angel. It's set up in a very Romeo and Juliet sort of way, with two people on different sides getting involved and the fallout from that. Making things more complicated is the fact that Angel was given his soul as a curse, And if he ever had a moment of true happiness, the curse is broken and his soul is lost. And he goes back to becoming a monster named Angelus. And he was truly, truly evil. And Angel and Buffy have their first time. Angel loses his soul. And then Buffy spends the second half of season two trying to save Angel from himself. It's a really great season. And then we had later on in season six or seven, Spike's great redemption story later. But Buffy started the whole idea of vampire as a doomed love interest. And if that was the extent of the romanticization of vampires, it might not have been quite that bad. But then you get to Twilight, where we get the whole idea of vampires that sparkle in sunlight, which is dumb on so many levels. But I think what I hate most about Twilight series is how unlikable these characters are. While the story tries to make you root for this ill-conceived love triangle between Bella Swan, the vampire Edward Cullen, and the werewolf Jacob. Now, when it comes to Twilight, a lot of people can't stand Edward. And I admit I'm not a fan either. I mean, he is a stalker. But honestly, the character I hate most is Bella. I mean, she's stringing these two guys along in the hopes of becoming a vampire herself. She's constantly acting manipulative and selfish, and she only ever acts for her own gain. She treats her horror-suffering father, the one likable character in the whole thing, like dirt. And then you have Edward, who is a creepy and controlling stalker. It's no wonder why Robert Pattinson spent so many years distancing himself from this role. I mean, Bella Swan is just so loathsome as a person, and I feel bad for these two guys who are sucked into her web. I don't know why anyone roots for any of these romances, because Bella is, in my mind, the villain of the piece and deserves to die alone. I really hate this character to no end.
God damn. You know, I really hate Twilight movies and their lore about vampires. Though I thought the werewolf lore was a lot cooler and more accurate to werewolf lore, but we'll get into that a bit. But my comment for now has got to be that I may hate Twilight, but you clearly have a deep-seated loathing for it. I don't think I've ever heard you describe something with that much animosity.
Maybe not. I will say, in fairness, though, that the idea of Native American vampires are really kind of interesting. It's just the execution wasn't there. But, I mean, and vampire romances can work. I mean, it's just that the way this one was done is shockingly poor in the execution. I mean, the problem is that these characters are just not sympathetic. They're not self-aware, and they're not likable in any way. Now, it was great for comedy, in fairness, and it sets a twist to the formula that way. The former hosts of Mystery Science Theater 3000 roasted the Twilight films on a show they did called Riff Tracks. And they've said more than once that Twilight is their favorite film to riff on because there's just so much material there. But probably my favorite swipe at Twilight and the dark, broody vampire boyfriend trope came from an episode of Supernatural. I mean, in that episode, there's a vampire who pretends to act like Edward Cullen as a way of seducing young women so he could feed on them. They take shots at Twilight constantly in that episode, and it is hilarious whenever they do.
Nice, nice. Supernatural is pretty good at taking shots when they decide to. I don't remember that episode off the top of my head, but I am certain you're right about it being hilarious. But as to the point about the different types of vampires, I personally think that when you get versions of the same creature, like vampires, or events like a world flood around the world that solidifies creatures as having existed, or an event having happened, even if it was misunderstood, told from different perspectives, or interpreted in different ways. You know, if 10 people saw the same accident, there would be some core things that they all saw happen, and several conflicting things that they all saw or experienced. I look at varying accounts of vampires or world flood or the same way. I'm not saying I 100% believe in all the accounts, just that I believe a creature, or at least something like what is in the accounts, perhaps just a blood drinker without all of the religious and superstitious connotations, something like vampire bats probably existed, because they are from cultures who did not interact much at all until the modern age, and yet they have common elements in their histories. As a side note, you might want to look into dragons sometime and see the varying types from around the world. What are your closing thoughts on vampires and commonalities of similar creatures around the world, Steve?
Mythology generally starts off as a way of trying to explain things that people can't rationally make sense of. I think that's very true of the vampire myth. There is truth to the idea of blood as a representation of life, and blood-based diseases aren't unheard of either. Likewise, horror is based on the fear of the unknown, and vampirism is an idea that was not understood by the people who created those legends. What we've been describing on this episode is a global myth being repeated over and over, which means that it transcends location and culture. But like many legends, it's evolved into its own cultural identity, changing and growing as our own understanding of the world does. But there's another bit of legend and folklore that we wanted to get into as well, isn't there?
There certainly is, Steve. And I'd like to describe a scene to kind of create the mood and shift the focus. The night falls and the moon sits high in the sky, shining its silver light across the fog-covered land. With beastly snarls, crackling of bone, and terrible howls, a man is changing. His bones break and reform. Coarse hair grows over his body as razor-sharp claws grow out of his fingernails. His facial bones have broken and are reforming into a wolf-like snout with terrible and vicious teeth. And with great ferocity, it sends out a howl into the moon that sends shivers down the spines of all who hear it. The creature is primal and ferocious, with an insatiable lust for violence and a never-ending font of stamina. Whether it be by satanic means, magic, or a call to the wild nature within us all, this is the werewolf. It is also our topic of discussion here. It would be wrong if we just talked about vampires and didn't bring up werewolves. It should be noted that while werewolves are the most popular, there are many types of were creatures in lore, including tigers, hyenas, jaguars, crocodiles, bears, and more.
Oh my! I think just about every animal has been used by as a lycanthrope of some kind at this point. Now I'll admit that I've even done it myself, and I have a Blix character coming up who is a werepanther, in fact. Narratively, there's a lot you can say about the relationship between human and animal through the idea of lycanthropy, but why don't we get into how the werewolf legend came to be, Mike?
Sure thing, Steve. The word werewolf comes from the Old English word were, meaning man and of course wolf. So it basically means man wolf or wolf man, as he is called among the universal monsters. One can become a werewolf by a variety of means, such as drinking a magic potion or ointment rubbed on the skin, or even a curse by a sorcerer or shaman. It was even said that sleeping under a full moon could turn someone. There are cases of wearing enchanted pelts or clothing transforming someone, and others where a person actually had werewolf parents. But there are also weird things that would seem odd to do, but apparently worked in the lore, like drinking water from a wolf paw print. I don't know. I have any idea why someone would drink water from a wolf's paw print, but I mean, that'd work apparently. But by far the most common way was to be bitten by a werewolf and survive the attack. But once a person is a werewolf, they are forever cursed with the transformation and become savagely violent on anyone they come across, like a mindless rabid beast. They are immune to sickness and disease and most forms of physical attacks. In fact, only the wolfbane plant, fire, decapitation, or a silver bullet could harm them. Once dead, they would revert back to their human form. It was said that any wounds the werewolf suffered while in its animal form could be seen on the human as scars, but they would have no memory of how or when they happened.
Shapeshifters in folklore go back a very long time, and animal shapeshifters tend to be the most common of these. Though I'm sure we'll get into this later, the lunar aspect of the werewolf is really interesting. But the thing with the werewolf is that the curse unlocks the animal instinct that the human buries to fit into society. So while the werewolf is often a separate persona from the victim of the curse, the question is how much the wolf represents the human victim's desire to hunt and feed. I mean, it's much like the Hulk as an aspect of Bruce Banner while also being a separate personality inside his mind.
Good analogy there. In fact, I have to believe that the Wolfman was an inspiration for the Hulk. I mean, as you said, the parallels are pretty strong. And building on that, as far back as the Stone Age, we can find depictions of gods and humans as half animals or beasts. So the idea of a half human, half animal creatures has been around for thousands of years. Think about the Egyptian gods, for instance. But as it pertains to wolves, they have long been feared and respected as hunters and combatants. They inspire awe and terror to ancient peoples. For man to take on the characteristics of a wolf was utterly terrifying. not just because they would be fierce and powerful, but because the transformation was seen as a loss of civility and a total embracing of our more primal state of chaos and savage natures. This unchecked morality and unbridled cruelty mixed with great power of a wolf made werewolves enter our deepest fear and nightmares. In fact, you'll see that throughout history of the werewolf, the common fear attached to them is this loss of civility and being overcome by a savage animal nature.
True. I think some of it is a very primal and primordial fear that goes back to the dawn of humanity. I mean, wolves were seen as savage predators until early humans found a way to tame them, and that led those wolves to become companion animals and eventually becoming the modern dog. Still, I don't think we've completely lost our fear of wild animals, and I think it's a necessary respect that we have for wolves because they can be powerful and dangerous, but this has also led to werewolves becoming anti-heroes in modern fiction, too. Wolves are savage predators, but they have their own rules that they live by. They're pack animals. I mean, they have a pecking order. They respect strength. When done right, they can be great as monsters or as anti-heroes fighting their animal nature. I mean, much as Wolverine does.
Another great comic book example. I remember worrying about whether or not Logan was going to go full beast was a regular concern in the X-Men comics I read. Mm-hmm. But let's get into the history of people turning into wolves and see just how far back it goes. The oldest story of a person turning into a wolf comes from the Mesopotamian epic of Gilgamesh. In that story, a woman curses an ex-lover, forever transforming him into a wolf. In Greek mythology, a king named Lycaon. Attempted to trick Zeus into eating the flesh of a murdered child. Outraged by this trickery and barbarism, Zeus transformed Lycaon and his whole family into wolves, or at least his sons. And here's a fun fact. It is from the name Lycaon that we get the word lycanthropy, which can mean either the supernatural power to change into a wolf-like creature or the psychological condition that leads one to believe that they can do that. In 425 BCE, Greek historian Herodotus mentioned the Nuri, a nomadic and magical tribe that transformed themselves into wolves for several days once per year. Herodotus himself does not believe the tale, but he says that those who tell the tale swear it to be true. Plato apparently even mentions that anyone who eats the entrails minced with that of a wolf will turn into a wolf. The Volsunga saga, Sigir, the king of Gotland, has a shape-shifting mother who turns into a wolf. And that same story, Sigmund and his son, Singolfi, come upon men sleeping in cursed wolf skins. Upon killing the men and putting on the wolf skins, they are cursed with a type of lycanthropy for 10 days, in which they go on a revenge-driven killing spree until Sigmund viciously attacks his own son in a disagreement. Singolfi is healed by a raven, and they shed the cursed pelts and rid themselves of the curse. A Blackfoot legend tells of a man who was left for dead by his wives, but was rescued by wolves. The alpha dog in the pack bestowed on the man a wolf-like form, and together with the wolf pack, he used his new powers to take vengeance on his wives by raiding their settlements and food stores. But actually, betrayal and revenge seems to take part in several werewolf stories, even on other continents. There was a Britannia story and a French story in the 1600s. Like with Milan and Bisclavet, who were also betrayed by their wives in a very Samson and Delilah-like way, where they reveal their secret of being a werewolf only to immediately have their wives using information against them. It's almost like betrayal and abandonment are part of the process across several countries. But back to the Native American stories. There are honestly multiple types of shapeshifters among Native American tribes, and the wolf or bear were common ones to turn into. But they were, of course, not the only ones. We're talking about taking the form of the animal and not some half-human hybrid creature. According to Cajun folklore in Louisiana, there are tales of a creature called the Rougarou, or the Lugaroo, who becomes a werewolf by becoming bewitched or failing to observe Lent 7 years in a row. When this happens, they transform every night for 101 days until the curse is passed on to another by biting or clawing. In Argentinian folklore, every seventh son becomes a werewolf. This actually led to a whole bunch of people like full on abandoning their seventh child, to even full on murdering them. And in order to stop people from killing their seventh sons or abandoning them, in 1920, the Argentinian president declared that they would become the godfathers of all these seven sons. In Turkic folklore says that Turkic Central Asian shamans, after performing a long and arduous rite, would be able to turn themselves into the Kurtadam, essentially a werewolf. But this is not a monster. The totemic ancestor of the Turks is actually a wolf. In medieval Icelandic folklore literature, there are two types of werewolves. One type transforms into a wolf, and in the other, the soul or spirit enters the animal's body. The most familiar example of the first type is the berserker, a warrior who is supernaturally endowed with the strength and ferocity of a wild animal, usually a wolf or a bear. Here's a tale I had not heard before, but apparently Ireland's St. Patrick turned the clan of Irishmen into werewolves. Back before Ireland was fully Christianized, St. Patrick was doing his best to convert the pagan clans to Christianity. One day he encountered a pagan tribe who was not just stubborn and resistant to his message. They took to mocking him and his God as well by howling into the sky as if they were wolves. The logic is probably that they consider St. Patrick's words to make no more sense than a wolf's howl, and so he only gets really what he deserves by being responded to in this way. Enraged, the saint prays to God for retribution. As a result, the tribesmen as well as their descendants now suffer from a werewolf curse. Some of them have to be trapped in wolfish form for 7 years in a row, while some of them have to go through the transformation every 7 years. I'm guessing the seven-year thing has to do with the year of Jubilee in the Bible, where all debts are forgiven every seventh year.
Could be. I mean, definitely there's significance to the number seven because it keeps cropping up all over the place. Okay. But like with the vampire myth, the werewolf seems to be everywhere throughout world folklore and legend. But I think it also makes sense as it reflects a longstanding fear and respect of the wolf. But more than that, it reflects a fear of the savage lurking inside ourselves and what might happen if we open the floodgates and stop trying to behave according to civilized rules. That is a universal fear that transcends culture, and that's probably why you see it over and over again.
I will admit that I have come to like rules and order. Those things not being present is pretty terrifying to me, and werewolves embody that fear. Like with our vampire discussion, we may write off werewolves as fictional creatures, but hundreds of years ago, these afflictions and others were very real and caused very serious hysteria. During the latter Middle Ages and into the late 16th century, while all the witch trials and persecution from church was sweeping across Europe, thousands were captured, tortured, tried, and beheaded for being werewolves. Things that could get one tried as a werewolf were things like having eyebrows that connected, hairy palms, which I think comes from something else. And this is one applied to vampires, too. Apparently, being a redhead could mean that, too. Another one I think is a little strange, and it is said that if you cut a werewolf in their human form, fur would come out of the open wound. But you didn't have to have any of those things. Just being an outcast from society could be enough to convict you. It is theorized that one plausible cause of hysteria could have come from a black fungus called ergot that infects rye bread and causes hallucinations when consumed. But not every case was so casually assigned. There were some genuinely dark people that were tried as well. In the 16th century, a Frenchman named Pierre Bergot and Michel Verdun allegedly swore allegiance to the devil and claimed to have an ointment that turned them into wolves. After confessing to brutally murdering several children, they were burnt at the stake. Another Frenchman from the same century named Gilles Garnet was dubbed the werewolf of Dole, who was also said to had an ointment that would change him into a wolf. And afterwards, he would attack and kill children like Bergot and Verdun. He too was burned at the stake. But whether they were insane or actually child murderers is still up for debate. However, even if they could be proven one way or another, I doubt that would have mattered to superstitious people who believed that only a savage beast or creature could commit such atrocities.
Likely not. With the werewolf, I think we're in the same a similar situation as the Blood Countess, where you have brutal, unspeakable acts being attributed to the work of a monster. And I can't help but wonder if this is the human mind trying to make sense of something this horrible and unspeakable. I mean, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around someone who would do savage and brutal things to other people, even today and with our knowledge of modern psychology. It must have been unfathomable to people who lived back then. I mean, it wasn't a person who did this awful thing. It was a werewolf. No human would act like that. I think it's just a case of people trying to rationalize things they can't explain.
You're 100% right about that. A lack of knowledge has been at the root of many monsters' myth and folklore. However, like with vampires, much of what we know or think of when we think of the werewolf comes from movies. In particular, the Universal monster movie The Wolfman from 1941. Changing under a full moon was from folklore, but it was cemented in our minds with that movie. And here's a little fun fact about the moon. Ancient superstition claims that a full moon or luna causes madness, and that's where we get the terms lunatic and lunacy from. So if you cross-reference that with werewolves being perceived as an abandonment of civility and an embrace of chaos and the primal nature, you can see the ancient connection with the moon and the werewolf. But back to things we learned from Hollywood. Another thing we got from them was that silver weapons, particularly silver bullets, were harmful to a werewolf. That became common knowledge with the film. It even came with a poem that was forever linked to werewolves. Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms, when the autumn moon is bright.
The lunar aspect of the werewolf is so fascinating. I mean, the moon has very often been used to explain madness, as you say. I mean, Moon Knight constantly is referred to as a lunatic. Just as the moon goes through phases, I mean, so does the werewolf, who became strongest during the full moon. I mean, the idea of silver as the werewolf's weakness is reflected in the lunar nature of the wolf. The moon is regarded as silvery. Gold is usually reflective of the sun, but silver is connected to the moon. So the werewolf is being damaged by the metal connected to the source of his power. The moon is also connected to sorcery and witchcraft. I mean, the great goddess Hecate had a lunar aspect, for instance. So the idea of the werewolf as a magic curse goes back to the idea of the moon as a source of dark magic. The traditional legend as presented werewolf films reflects those old superstitions.
You know, I had never actually thought of the silver weakness or the moon as a source of dark magic in that manner before. But I have to say that's brilliant. That is definitely how I'm going to see it from now on. Another big one that contributed to the werewolf lore was 1981's An American Werewolf in London, which focused on the psychological aspects of being a werewolf versus movies like The Howling from that same year, which was more about the raw sexuality of a savage beast. Honestly, I thought they were kind of reaching with the Howling series. But then, of course, there are films like Van Helsing or the Underworld franchise, which pit werewolves against monster hunters or covens of vampires. One of the reasons that werewolves might be growing in popularity these last couple of decades is because, unlike other vampires, werewolves are only monsters temporarily and get to be human the rest of the time.
That's fair points. I barely remember that film now, American Werewolf in London. I remember going to see it when I was really young, but I really don't remember much in the way of details. I do remember it being influential, though. Now, there was one other werewolf movie that I do want to mention, and that is the original Teen Wolf. That movie was written by someone comics fans would know, Jeff Loeb. Yes, the same Jeff Loeb that wrote Batman The Long Halloween, Superman for All Seasons, and the Marvel Color books. Now, we talked about Michael J. Fox in our discussion of Back to the Future, but this is another early film that he was known for, and he's good in this one, too. I mean, I think this is where Teen Wolf is interesting, is that it plays on the wolf as a metaphor for teenage struggles and the changes that teens go through during high school. It also gets a little less serious, which is also very different from most werewolf films you see now. You can play the werewolf trope for laughs and make it work without getting too silly. I can't speak for any of the follow-ups they've done, either the sequel with Jason Bateman or the reboot, but the original movie was a neat take on the idea.
Hell yeah, dude. I bet I watched Teen Wolf a good 5 or 6 times growing up. And it definitely walked that line between funny and silly, and that was all Fox. I got to give him all the credit there. That was the first time I'd ever thought about becoming a werewolf and what it might like what it might actually be like. I have to say, though, that my favorite version of vampires and werewolves comes from the Underworld franchise. I love the backstory that they gave on the vampires and the werewolves, or rather lycans, as they are called in that franchise. It all started with a man named Alexander Corvinus, who was the world's first immortal. They don't explain where his immortality comes from, but that's kind of a moot point in describing this. Alexander had three sons, Marcus, who was bitten by a bat and became a vampire, and William, who was bitten by a wolf and became the very first lycan. The third son apparently did not carry the immortality gene that Marcus and William carried, and he lived a mortal life and had mortal descendants all the way down to Michael Corvinus, who we meet in the first Underworld movie, that becomes the very first vampire lycan hybrid, a being more powerful than either race on its own. In the Underworld franchise, lycans were created when William Corvinus went on his murderous rampage through towns. Those that survived his attacks would turn into lycans. When we get to the second film, Evolution, when that opens up, we see Marcus, Victor, and Amelia, along with a few other vampires, tracking down William and burning down bodies of his victims so that they won't turn into lycans. They eventually capture William and imprison him. But the feud between the lycans and the vampires was born that day. The vampires, with positions of wealth, power, and authority as kings and queens of their lands, captured all of the lycans and turned them into lower class slave race. I mean, it's no surprise that in the third film, Rise of the Lycans, we see the lycans rebel against this treatment by their vampiric overlords, and the war between them goes into full swing. I don't know what it is exactly, but I love this mythology and that the two monster races are at war with one another. Plus, Selene and Michael Corvinus are just badass characters.
You know, thinking about it now, I can't help but wonder if Michael Corvinus was based on Michael Corleone. I mean, it's the names and the fact that both Michaels are like on the outs with their families at first. Now, I have not watched all the Underworld movies, I do remember enjoying the first one. And I know what you mean about not having an exact finger about why it works. I can't tell you exactly why this is either, but it seems like the Shakespearean angle of star-crossed lovers is just a perfect fit when it comes to anything to do with vampires. We've seen it with Buffy, but it's also definitely true here, except in Underworld, it plays out as a vampire-werewolf love story between two warring houses. There's some really strong world building in this film, and even though you know there's more than what they tell you, they give you enough to make you want to see what the twist ultimately is. Also, I mean, Kate Beckinsale is a really good lead heroine, and she sells the Selene character extremely well, whether it's in the character or in the action scenes.
You know, not necessarily wanting to be a part of the struggles of our parents suffered through, and wanting to strike out on our own is something I think all people who have lived through being a teenager can understand. Add to that the forbidden love of being with someone disapproved by our parents, and the thrill of the defiance for love, for the love of it all that makes it so irresistible. I've been in relationships where others, especially those in authority, were disapproving of what we were doing when I was a teenager, and it just fueled the fire of our passion. So that's all easy for I think a lot of folks to understand. But then you add a righteous cause to it, like what's going on with the covens of vampires and their pursuit of Michael just for being what he is. And there's basically no backing down at that point. I think that's got to be at least part of it. I mean, besides the great action being a great action flick too.
That totally makes sense now that you mentioned that. I mean, that kind of situation creates a lot of tension with the families doing everything possible to keep the couple apart. I mean, you want Michael and Selene to make things work somehow against impossible odds, both because we care about their struggle and because it shows that peace between the two sides is possible. It's a really uplifting theme with the idea that love can overcome deep differences.
Yeah, the Underworld movies are really great. Well, that was a big old monster deep dive, wasn't it? So thank you for listening. And I'd like to take this moment to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.